Hello and welcome. My name is Kirsten Johnston and I'm the chair of the Marketing Focus Group at the British Chamber of Commerce Shanghai. This is our fourth episode of season two in the Live Lounge podcast series, where we take a China perspective on maximising brand Scotland. This podcast was recorded in front of a live audience at the British Centre in Shanghai, home of Scottish Development International. It explores the current opportunities for Scottish SME businesses to export to China, circumnavigating the category of premium consumer goods. Topics include how to leverage your Scottishness in China and what opportunities lay ahead for Scottish brands selling to the growing middle-class Chinese market. During the panel discussion, I speak to Kevin Liu, Head of Greater China and Energy Trade Lead for Scottish Development International, as well as two successful Scottish premium textile brands already operating in China. This includes Josh Lane from Holland & Sherry and Jeffrey Xu from Beg & Co. Supporting the panel is Lee Folland, Director of Research at Reuters Communications, and Simon Lee, Managing Director of IMX, International Merchandise Exchange and Exhibition. Whilst we're privileged to have Kevin Liu from SDI on our panel, he was unable to attend the session in person, but was able to dial in from the UK, so we apologise for the less than perfect sound quality of his voice. So without further ado, let's enter the Maximising Scotland Live Lounge. Okay, so Kevin, I'm going to start with you. I mean, Scottish Development International is part of a government-funded trade organisation. Perhaps can you just tell me a little bit about SDI?
So SDI is the international arm of an agency called Scottish Enterprise, which is headquartered in Glasgow, and it is the business agency of the Scottish government. Now, Scottish Enterprise looks after Scotland's domestic economic landscape. It supports businesses with everything from regulatory assistance to fundraising to looking at grant applications across the whole of the UK and also from EU sources. And SDI was created in 2001 to be the international extension of that.
So you've just launched, or SDI's been involved in launching the Scotland Is Now campaign. Perhaps can you just tell us the reasons why that's been launched and what you hope to achieve out of that?
Yeah, sure. I think we really need to look at what businesses need from the Scottish Government in terms of overseas business support. And really, from the consultations that we've undertaken over the past couple of years, it's really about presenting what Scotland's offer is with a central, single, unified voice. And it's not about telling people what agencies you work with having different brands and different logos and operating in silos. That's precisely what really undermines a lot of the good, genuine efforts of what we're trying to do all around the world, but including and especially in a big complex market like China. So whenever we go out, we don't actually present ourselves as SDI or indeed the Scottish Government. We present Scotland Is Now, because that's about supporting business, and that's fundamental to what that campaign is trying to achieve.
Just to bring that into context, I mean, currently roughly how much is Scotland exporting to China specifically? And through this brand campaign, what sort of future target do you have in terms of impacting exports to China?
Sure. As I said, Scotland is punching well below its weight. If you were to compare us with other similar size small nations, to take Belgium, for example, fairly similar population size and almost exactly per capita. Belgium exports around £7 billion worth of products and services to China a year. And, you know, we are well short of that, of course, only about a tenth of that. So that is the size of the task that we face. Now, Scotland Is Now tries to at least elevate our single unified offer by presenting the range of products and services that we're trying to export under one single roof. And whether that's through the multimedia assets through the social media channels, through now a Chinese website, and being much more ambitious with our marketing activities and campaigns going forward under, again, the Scotland Is Now brand, we believe we're able to then really promote Scotland's offer with much more vision. So to give you an example, I actually just had a conversation with our consumer industries team here in Edinburgh earlier about being much more creative with big headlining, impactful events and marketing campaigns that cut across different demographics, that cut across different marketing channels. And quite frankly, that's not been something that SDI has been very strong at over the past few years anywhere in the world.
I mean, critics might say that's great from a marketing perspective, and it's maybe creating a whole lot of noise about Scotland. But really, what's the follow through? What are you actually going to do on the ground that's going to make a real difference to the bottom line of businesses and possibly introduce new businesses, new industries into China that Scotland has never traditionally been involved with?
Sure. So you're looking at four of them in the room today. And our Shanghai team is a great example of the body of specialist knowledge that we're trying to set up here in China. And this is partly why we've adopted this cross-sectoral matrix structure to really allow our sector specialists to further develop their expertise and to really help companies through objective analysis of opportunities, through careful, considered introductions. But most fundamentally, we've now adopted something called a trade development approach. And in essence, that means we are looking further ahead at long-term opportunities. Instead of only facilitating introductions to a single buyer, we're looking at a set of buyers. We're looking at a body of businesses that in the long term, Scotland can then do business with. So it's really about magnifying what we're trying to do here. And that can only be done with the team we've set up on the ground.
Just lastly, I mean, you say Scotland is now. Why is now a good time?
Well, it's now or never, to be honest. We could forever look at the future, but we have to understand that businesses face imminent decisions on a daily basis. And having been a businessman myself, I understand that logic. We can forever try and look at the long term, but we can only afford so much thought leadership. It's all about cash flow. It's all about sometimes exporting our way out of economic malaise. And it's all about finding new sources of revenue now. So Scotland has to be now.
Brilliant. Okay, Kevin, we'll hold on the line because I'm going to come back to you towards the end. So I'm now going to talk to Lee Follin. So Lee, you're part of Reuters Communications. Reuters has been operating in China for about 10 years or so in PR and communications for luxury brands. Do you want to just give a quick background into Reuters and some of your experience?
Thank you very much for having me on the panel. So my name is Lee Follin. I'm the head of research at Reuters Communications. We focus on helping premium luxury brands really engage with the Chinese consumer. And we work across sectors from hospitality to beauty, jewelry, fashion, as well as lifestyle. We have a lot of British brands and some Scottish brands.
What can you perhaps share with us about the Chinese consumer today and their appetite for premium imported products?
It's perhaps valuable to look at it through a couple of examples. Premium baby foods is a really easy one. We've seen the share of foreign baby brands increase significantly. It was around 30% in the past 10 years. Another one is instant noodles. A couple of years ago, premium instant noodle brands contributed about 7% off the market, and now it's around 12%. So you can see, even in something that we really consider a fast food is getting lifted because of rising incomes. The consumers demand more, they want more variety. So even the most basic goods are getting uplifted.
I mean, you're talking mainly about the growing middle class of China, right? So, I mean, how big is the middle class if the 1.3 billion figure is not accurate for marketing towards? So how big is this market?
That's a really tricky question because how do you go about defining what middle class is? There are definitions by the Bureau of Statistics that say you're a middle income earner if you earn about £2,500 a year. And then there's PricewaterhouseCoopers that define middle middle class as 50,000 US a year. So it varies, but I think the figures vary between 100 million and 400 million. So it's not 1.3 billion.
So maybe quantifying is not really the right way. I mean, how would you characterize a middle class consumer then? What sort of behaviors do they have?
I guess increasingly white collar. An interesting shift we've seen is obviously growth coming from lower tier cities. So a lot of brands used to focus on your Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou. That's no longer the case. You see retail sales growing faster in lower tier cities. Incomes are growing faster in tier two, three cities.
I'm sorry, that's for luxury or premium brands, is it?
That's just looking at the demographics, right, and the economy. But luxury specifically, we see the growth is really being propelled by lower tier cities as well.
Obviously, the topic today really is about maximising Scotland, and we know a little bit about the Scotland Is Now campaign. So that, to me, is really about nationalising a brand and creating that brand, which has to carry through the message of Scotland. How do you feel, or do you feel that's a realistic message that we can deliver to Chinese consumers? Do you think they would really understand a brand campaign like Scotland Is Now, based on your experience, and how do you think that could be leveraged?
Leveraging those national identities is very valuable and can be a point of differentiation for brands, for sure. And we've seen lots of examples where that's been done well. And we work with a lot of foreign brands where we try and incorporate those national opponents into our communications, the engagements and the activities that we do. So recently for Harrods, for example, during the Shanghai Fashion Week, we brought in the Harrods residents, where we had doormen from Harrods, we had afternoon tea, we had the teddy bears at the Middle House Hotel here in Shanghai, and we invited media, we invited influencers to really experience Harrods experience.
Okay, well, I might talk to Josh if that's okay. So Josh, you're from Holland and Sherry, so maybe just tell us a little bit about who Holland and Sherry are and where, what the heritage is or where you're from.
Okay, thanks, Kirsten. Hello, everyone. So Holland and Sherry is a British fabric supplier. They're one of the oldest cloth merchants still in existence today. They're founded in 1836, so almost 200 years history already. We specialize in wool products, specifically selling to bespoke tailors, high-end retailers, and also ladies' wear designers around the world. So we're very much positioned at the premium end of the market. We face quite a unique landscape because we are a B2B company, but at the same time, we're a luxury proposition. So we face quite a tricky task of actually conveying that message to the end consumer, because typically there's a few degrees of separation from me down to a gentleman who walks into a tailor shop looking to buy a Holland and Sherry fabric suit. Certainly, the brand of Britain resonates quite strongly in the Chinese market. If you're looking at the textiles industry where we're coming from, the two major players are Italy and the UK. I think Britain is winning that brand battle slightly. Icons like the Queen, James Bond, or the quintessentially British gentleman does seem to have an impact on a Chinese person who's looking to buy a suit. Going a little bit further down the chain, as we try to differentiate ourselves with other British suppliers, I have found success drawing on the Scottish identity. I think Scotland has a particularly strong Scottish national identity, even from quite a crude generalistic point of view. If you think about whiskey, tartan, think the image of a man wearing a kilt is kind of burned onto the image of a lot of people's mind from around the world. And then from a fabric point of view, I think, yeah, the Czechs, the tartans, our warehouse is in a very small town in Scotland called Peebles. It's in the borders region. It's not very strategically located, but it's got a great story. And when we're trying to kind of convey our narrative as a luxury brand, it is quite nice to be able to lean on that very authentic, don't want to say cottagey, kind of artisan brand. More boutique, I suppose, would be a good way to say it.
Well, I suppose the brand, as part of the brand of Scotland, or the Scotland Is Now campaign, it was talking about craftsmanship. And how much do you think that story of craftsmanship is embedded in sort of Scottishness, or is it just generally a UK story?
Well, I mean, when you look at the UK from a Chinese point of view, it's a very small place. It's quite hard for them to, maybe I'm talking too generally, but trying to get a Chinese person to explain the difference between Great Britain, the United Kingdom, England, Wales, Scotland. On the map, we're a little dot. So I think generally speaking, it's associated with the UK. But for those, let's say, in the luxury segment of the market, those who have traveled to Europe, those who probably have been to Edinburgh, I think they have a slightly more informed opinion of of the different identities from Scotland versus England or Wales or somewhere else?
We mentioned earlier, I mean, you're technically a B2B brand. You know, you're obviously selling into tailors, etc. But you do have an eye on the consumer and what their tastes are, and I suppose what their impression is of you as either a Scottish brand or a UK brand. I mean, how would you leverage something like the Scotland Is Now campaign in your business here in China?
Well, I think I'll have to have a chat with Kevin first of all.
You're allowed to say it's of no relevance.
we're a peculiar company because we're relatively small. We're not looking for huge volume. We have good margins. Actually, we do more of our sales through what I would consider relationship marketing. That applies anywhere in the world, but it probably rings most true in China because the relationship is so important. So let's take, for example, China has 20, even a conservative estimate, if China has 20,000 tailors and we are familiar or connected to the top 1% of those tailors and we have 200 customers, China's our biggest market in the world. So as a result, I think most of my time is spent on trying to develop those relationships locally, passing on that brand story very, very directly, but also concisely, because actually we sell through distributors and then the distributors sell to a tailor, then the tailor passes on to his sales staff. By the time a sales staff is selling to somebody looking to buy a suit, maybe all they remember is that we're Scottish. And then at least then we still have a way to differentiate ourselves against a load of other British brands.
That sounds like a sort of slow approach in terms of growing your business in China. So there'll probably be a lot of listeners to the podcast wondering how they can introduce their brand into China. And then I think a lot of perception is that China is so fast that they have to move fast. They have to behave in a quick fashion. Would you agree with that? Or how did you enter China? I mean,
well, we have the fortunate position of functioning as a startup. It's myself. I'm the one employee for Asia, but we have the backing of a very strong brand back in the UK, and that's never really going to go away unless I do something terribly wrong. And so actually they are encouraging more of a conservative approach. It's a bit of trial and error. Actually, Holland & Sherry has been selling in China for more than 10 years. We've only had a physical presence probably the last 5 years, and the longer you spend here, it's quite cliche, but the more you realize you don't know. But at the same time, what's never going to be considered wasted time is getting to know the key players in the market, the kind of mega trends, the trajectories for where the economy is going. And from a fabric point of view, you know, what do the wealthy people want to buy? And actually right now, tweed is gaining a little bit of traction. Harris tweed is an example which kind of mirrors the story which Kevin was talking about from the small whiskey distillery. You know, it's to be considered Harris tweed, it has to be woven. Everything has to be completed on a tiny island in the Outer Hebrides. It's a powerful story. It's a little bit romanticized, but kind of has an impact because people now, they want something boutique or artisan, handcrafted, very, very customized. And I think when we're gaining traction against some of the luxury brands, some of the historical luxury brands, who there's nothing preventing somebody or the next 1,000 people from buying exactly the same garment. So with something like a Harris tweed in a tailor shop, that garment is unique in many ways. It's created for your body shape, first and foremost. And then you've had some input on the design and obviously the choice of fabric as well.
Great. Okay, well, I might move on to Jeffrey. So you're from Beg & Co.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. I'm Jeffrey. I'm from Beg & Co. I'm practicing my Scottish accent.
None of us have a Scottish accent on this panel.
So let's talk about Beg & Co. So we are a luxury cashmere brand, and we established in 1866 in the city of Ayr, which is close to Glasgow, 1 hour driving. So we are really proud of everything we produced, from the designing stage to the manufacturing stage. Everything is made in Scotland. Even the packaging is made in Scotland. We are very proud of that. And for the brand, we start to exporting to many different areas, including US and Japan, at a very early stage. But we entering the Chinese market in 2015. Our product range currently is about men's and women's accessories and some interior sections. For this autumn winter 19 season, we just launched our knitwear collections. So we are expecting to grow the category of the brand in the next few years.
So you just mentioned that you've had some presence in other Asian cities, so yeah. Namely Tokyo and Japan, is that correct? Yeah. So tell us, you know, how is the China market, because you've only recently entered China, so how is this different from the other experiences you've had in Asia as a brand?
I think the main difference, if we compare to the Japanese market, I think the consumer will be the main difference, their shopping habits and their taste. I think obviously the Japan is more mature as a retail market, and also the retail structures is quite different compared to China and Japan. In Japan, you can find tons of the department stores like Wako's, Takashimaya's, and many of Eastern's, many of the department stores. But in China, I'm afraid at this point, most of the luxury spending is at monobrand stores. It's not a very established department stores. And the other thing will be different from those two markets. It's going to be the local competitions. In China, we're also facing very strong local competitions from the Mongolia side and Inner Mongolia. So they are producing also very nice products. But in Japan, we kind of don't have those kind of compositions.
So would you say then the Japanese consumer is more aware of a product coming from Scotland, for example, than a Chinese consumer? I mean, do you think the Chinese consumer is really just looking at the cashmere and making a decision about your brand versus maybe a local brand?
No, I think as the economy grows, the Chinese consumers change constantly. So they are changing the taste, they're changing very fast, they're becoming more mature, and they understand the products, they understand the brand and the brand value behind that, and also the stories. So I think what they are really looking for is the brand as a whole experience. It's not like you're selling a cashmere product. They want to know everything behind the products, the people behind the products, the craftsmanship. So I think that's the main change for this market.
And so does that change your marketing strategy in China? I mean, do you have to deliberately tell a bigger brand story to this market compared to others? Or are you following exactly the same strategy that you did for Japan, for example?
I think we're following the strategies now. So we are, as we begin our entering the Chinese market, we start in work, we're starting working with boutique stores like KT Lowe's in Wukang Road in Shanghai and News in Shanghai, and Brills in Beijing, those kind of very sophisticated boutique stores. But we quickly start to expand our business in the department stores. Like we are in SKP in Beijing, both men's and women's department. We are in Lianhuafo in Hong Kong. And for this season, we'll be launching our collections in Shanghai store as well.
Okay, so you've obviously been under an umbrella of a department store or a boutique store, which has already established itself into sort of a premium or luxury end. You're piggybacking onto those, and you're selling your product through those channels, which is great, and it's sort of a safety net. But is that your future? I mean, do you see yourself growing that way, or do you want to be independent?
I think as we grow our categories, we are starting to think of that. But as Lee said earlier, our main priority for next few years will be like a second-tier cities of China. I think there's a huge potential in those cities compared to like the major cities we have now.
Well, can you tell us a bit about the second-tier cities? What do you see as the opportunity?
I think the spending, I think they obviously have spending powers over there, and the lack of options really makes them to want to spend more. Like, for example, if people live in Shanghai, they can easily travel to Japan to shop over there. But for people living in Chengdu, it's not quite a usual thing for them to do. So it's that's also the very crucial part for those consumers in those cities to be able to know your brand and to be able to purchase your brand.
Well, yeah. You're talking about accessibility, which
accessibility,
might
yes.
be a good time to switch over to Simon, actually, because Simon's part of IMX, which stands for International Merchandise Exchange and Exhibition. That's a mouthful. So we'll just call it IMX. Simon, just tell us a bit about it, because I know that this business is just starting. In effect, you're a startup. But tell us a bit about why you're starting now and what the main offer is of IMX.
IMX, it's a direct result of the Chinese government's policy to focus on trade and imports in addition to the other wonderful industries that we have established already. Now, if you can take a look at the latest policy, if I give an example, the Hongqiao Business District in the other side of town, right? It was farmland just 4 years ago, but now we have the biggest national convention center, and as well as we were one of the early patrons to that area, where we have established 27 corporate villas, 15-story office building, and also an exhibition center. Transportation infrastructure that's been built out of that area, you can technically reach either by plane, by train, or by car. Within 2 hours, you reach 1 billion. China, in the year 2018, had exports valued at $2 trillion. You want to guess the import amount? It shocked me the first time I saw that data. 1.4 trillion. So import is 70% of China's export. That's saying a lot, especially if you look at how this country demographic and income has been rising in the last decade, if not two decades. So this is, I guess these are the two main reasons that we have established IMX last year. And we were one biggest exhibitor at last year's China International Import Exhibition, CIIE, championed by the one and only President Xi. And this year, we are again one of the leading exhibitors there, wanted to showcase. So what does IMX do? I've spent 5 minutes, right? I haven't talked about what IMX does. We are a platform which, first and foremost, serve Chinese consumers who wanted to look at international quality products. And by the same token, we serve also international product makers, merchants, to bring the products to China and everyone else in between. We do not manufacture any hardcore products, but we are, as a platform, we provide the necessary services for people in this ecosystem to be successful. For example, market entry. You wanted to set up a shop in China. You wanted to get product licenses for your products to be sold here. You wanted to register for IP, intellectual property. We have services like that, right? And then also consumer intelligence. You want to find out where exactly are people focusing or spending their money on high-end textiles, right? You wanted to find out what is the age group of the people spending on such textiles and in other categories. Last but not least, we definitely provide services. We invite service providers on our platform so that they can compete for your business if you were to have a product to bring to China, in logistics, in trade finance, in business consultant, in advertising promotion. We have several key opinion leaders, KOLs, where they know the appetite of their constituents or their followers down to the village level, right? So this is what you need to penetrate into China through the local distribution and promotion channel. That's also available on the IMX platform. Now, I could go on for another 2 hours, but I think we should stop here a little bit.
Well, can I just quickly ask you, you talked about policy, because I mean, why is this happening now? Why didn't this happen 10 years ago? I mean, you know, tell us a little bit about the policies of importation and maybe even the free trade zone.
Right. Now, step by step, Chinese authorities have instituted pieces that we need to establish a good ecosystem of import-export. Now, we have the famous free trade zone, started in 2013, the first one. I think we do have 15 of them now in China. And then a couple of years ago, we started to have this cross-border e-commerce infrastructure, where as bonded warehouses, where it's essentially helping to lower taxes for imports in specific areas. It's almost like government creating a loophole for itself to lower taxes. Well, I don't hear that every day, right? No, but then this is being put into place where things are needed. Ports are being upgraded, right? We have an excellent online platform. I'm sure we all have heard about November 11th. I think it was $285 billion in the first 24 hours on that day. And it was commerce exchange between 210 countries. So it's no longer a China festival, if you will, right? It's a global phenomenon. And that's also adds to the fact that infrastructure being put in place on top of rising consumer disposable income, as well as the desire to look at quality products outside of China. I think these are the three factors that make what we are today.
Well, some of those sort of sale bonanza days tend to be focused on discount models. And here we're talking about premium brands and luxury brands who probably don't offer discount models. I'm assuming that's right.
Right.
And IMX, I believe, is focusing on SME brands. Is that right? Perhaps tell us a little bit about why is IMX suitable, say, for a premium or luxury brand or a small family business that maybe did start way back in 1800s.
Yep. Maybe we should talk afterwards, but let me give this example first. Now, we have been working with a Norwegian company which produces sweaters for kids. It's a special kind of wool which helps sensitive skin on babies, which happens a lot in China. And the entire manufacturing process is divided into 11 steps, and each one of those steps, not only the tools, but also the materials used have been certified by the European Union as non-toxic, sustainable, and friendly to the environment. So these are the things that Chinese parents are looking for, but not available domestically. this is what we would call a premium kind of product that IMX would like to work with. It solves a big problem when your kids are actually sleeping at night as opposed to scratching. And it's not that expensive. The last time I checked, it was 480 RMB per set. So this is what we're talking about, right? Another case that we're working on is a German craft beer maker, which has been in the Northern Bavaria region since 1763 or something like that. They also make a non-alcoholic version of the craft beer. So this is something that has not entered China before or not significantly being marketed. That's also something we would like to work
with. So Simon, are you actually sort of curating brands that you feel is going to work for the China market? And how are you making that decision? Because you could have 14 craft beer brands approach you.
Right.
How are you going to know which ones are going to be right for China?
We're actually working with the Forbes magazine, create a list by survey and other means. I think the list is right now, the tentative name is called Most Desirable Imports into China. Right, we have divided into six categories. We have some preliminary names put in those lists as candidates, where we would go through a body of phenomenal beer drinkers and other product users to make sure that we come up with formula and do this on a year in and year out basis.
And I have to ask this question because I hear it a lot here from people involved. And I know, how are you going to connect the brands with the buyers and distributors? Because are you going to follow that traditional model where it's offline retail, or is there new ways?
It's actually quite a bit of a hybrid, right? Right now, we're focusing on B2B, where we will link up product producers from all around the world to distributors and merchandisers in China. Now, we work closely with the Federation of Chinese Business Leaders, as well as a couple of other similar trade bodies within China, where they are representing different distributors on a regional basis. We wanted to take our products, the products that we represent, to attend the trade shows. So it will be essentially a roadshow on an annual basis. By the time you finish the 36 provinces, it will be December again. Right, but that's what we intend to do. We wanted to make sure quality products get the airtime in different parts of China, and that's one way. We are looking for ways to go to B2C, but that will probably be in a year or so, if not 2 years. Right now, we're focusing on SMEs to SMEs.
So I think really for people to be entering, they've got to be talking to the bridging platforms. They probably also have to talk to existing Scottish brands here in China, right? And then I guess talking to the communications and PR groups just to get the up-to-date information, because it seems like this market is rapidly changing. Hopefully we've still got Kevin on the line. I just want to bring it back to you because based on what you've heard today, I mean, we're at a very sort of interesting time in UK's political history. We're recording this just before potentially UK may exit the EU. And obviously that's impacting people in Scotland. Do you feel now is the time for Scottish brands to be thinking more about China? And does, in some sort of way, Brexit help opportunity of export to China?
I think regardless of Brexit, even if we're not having the political conversation we're having now in the UK, people have to look at China as the next destination, because China is not going to be waiting for Scottish businesses to wake up to, and that's a fact. And, you know, judging by just how competitive the foreign trade and investment scene in China already is, if Scottish businesses don't act now, then it will be too late. And you know, Brexit is perhaps an instigator of that, but it's really an afterthought, I think, for many businesses, or at least this should be.
And I just have to ask, you know, you're in UK right now. What do you think that people have a very true perception of what China really is like in UK right now? I mean, or do you feel you have to educate people an awful lot about the China market before they really wake up to see the opportunity?
Yeah, sure. Having been involved with UK-China business on and off for over a decade, I can certainly see an increase in familiarity and expertise in China across the whole of UK. And a lot of that has just been facilitated by increased trade and investment, and just simply more people doing business in China, or at least traveling to China and prospecting for further opportunities. There's always something more to be learned, of course. And I really agree with one of the panelists' comments on looking at second-tier cities, third-tier cities. You know, I've always held high the notion of you have have to be a hero for turning up. And for me, that means, you know, you have to go somewhere and really being treated as, you know, something that's kind of almost a novelty. You have to bring something new to the market, and you have to be really presenting yourself in that light as well. And, you know, it's very much a big country problem. It's evident in China, India, the US, etc. And in China, you have to select your market right. There's no such thing as conquering China. You know, plenty of people have tried that and pretty much failed. You know, Samsung closed their last advanced smartphone factory over the weekend, and they've now pretty much given up on conquering China, despite the fact that 10 years ago they had 20% market share and now barely 2. So really you have to go in with the right strategy, and it's about being the hero for turning up.
Oh, that's a really good point. So thank you very much, Kevin. So I guess for any Scottish SME brands listening, how do they get in contact with SDI? Can SDI be their first point of contact to discussing China opportunities?
Well, I should hope so. That would be good, and that would be a good testament of our job being done well. So we offer various touch points depending on where they are. If they are in Scotland, they should get in touch with the team in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Dundee, or Inverness, and they'll be able to reach out to trade advisors in their respective sectors with relative ease. Everyone's contact details, faces, etc., are all listed on the SDI website. And once they have decided to at least come out to market and start exploring the opportunities in the field, that's when that will get passed to us for further development. And, you know, one of my colleagues, including myself, depending on the sectors that we're dealing with, would then be able to help with that process. And it's a very much a tailored, bespoke support that we provide. It's all based on what's actually been needed, everything from partner selection to looking at potential retail and distribution channels, to looking at some of the funding requirements that they might have, and looking at some of the long-term strategies that perhaps they're struggling with before knowing China in that depth.
Well, I'd just like to say thank you to the panel for this evening. So Simon, Josh, Jeffrey and Lee, and Kevin for joining us here.
And that concludes our fourth Live Lounge episode for season 2. We hope you enjoyed listening. If you'd like to get in touch with any of the panelists who participated in this episode, including the SDI, or if you have a business topic you would like to hear on a future podcast, please contact the team at the British Chamber of Commerce Shanghai, who would be very delighted to hear from you. I'm Kirsten Johnston. Thank you for listening.